This episode courtesy of Gretsch Drums and that great Gretsch sound. Visit GretschDrums.com to see the latest gear and sign up for the Gretsch newsletter.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Is drummer right? Is it okay to say drummer?
Pounding his pulsing beat into the hearts of all America.
You motherfuckers are fucking all over this joint.
You do your kind of drumming, and I'll do my kind of drumming.
I have no more time. You don't know what I'm up against.
The only things I care about in this goddamn life are me and my drums and you.
The official explanation was he choked on vomit.
You suppose maybe I could put the drums in your place and sort of drop in once in a while?
Now back to Gene Krupa's syncopated style shortly.
Get up there behind those drums, lean back, close your eyes, get right on the groove there, give it a good steady beat.
I got blisters on my fingers!
I'd hit that.
I'm in Austin, Texas. Billy Pittman. Billy, thank you for having me over today, man.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure to have a visitor over here at the warehouse.
This is a really interesting spot. We were talking about it. We'll get back to it. You played last night.
Yeah.
You are a member of the Jimmy Vaughn Band, and you were saying 25 years.
25 years in June.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's been a long time. And when I got the gig, I thought that my musical career was over. You know.
Let's get into that. What does that even mean? What was going on at that point?
Well, I had just moved out to California to LA with my son, who was 15 at the time. And I was...
From where? Where did you move?
From Richmond, Virginia.
Okay.
Which I grew up in Lynchburg, which is central Virginia, more in the mountains. And Richmond was the big city. And I had bands there and stuff, played music there and stuff. But I split up with my son's mother, and we moved out to Venice, California, as far west as we could go. And, you know, I was thinking I was going to play, but I needed a job. So I started, you know, I was a cook, had been a cook for years at that point. So I got a job and tried to do some gigs because I had played, when I had first gone to L.A. in the early 90s with my band, the Useless Playboys, out of Virginia. There was a big scene happening, you know, kind of like rockabilly, backyard parties, places to play. And so I thought I'd continue doing that, but it was drying up by the 96, by the time I moved out there. And I was, you know, I played a few gigs, but you'd have to drive to, you know, I lived in Venice or Silver Lake, and you'd have to drive to Anaheim to practice with these... And, you know, gigs is no money. So I just didn't think it wasn't going anymore. So.
Did you stop?
Well, I mean, I was playing with my girlfriend at the time. She was a singer, and we were doing standards. You know, just I'd play guitar and she'd sing. And yeah, we weren't doing much, but I was thinking that, you know, we could get something together. But that was falling apart. And, you know, I had a job. I was a great short order cook at this place on Sunset Boulevard in Silver Lake called Millie's. It was, you know, I had good friends there. It was happening. So it was, I thought that's what was going on. My friend Steve Wertheimer from Austin called me up Memorial Day weekend. He was out for a car show and he was with Jimmy, and he called me up and said, "Billy P, your life is going to change." And he said, "I'm coming by tomorrow to have breakfast with Jimmy Vaughn. He's looking for a guitar player." So they came over to, you know, on Sunset Boulevard, a little lunch counter where I was a short order cook. And put, you know, came. It was perfect because
they visited you at work.
Yeah, it was a really busy spot. But they came in, of course, late in the day, so there was parking right out front, and they drove up in like a 32 Ford hot rod and a 59 Studebaker pickup, purple with yellow flames on it, right up front in front of the plate glass window. Came in, and you know, I talked to talked to Jimmy before. Of course, he didn't remember seeing the T-Birds back in the day, you know.
Where had you seen them, by the way?
In Virginia.
Okay.
Yeah, they back in the
original lineup.
Yeah, yeah, with Keith and I never saw him with Mike Buck.
Oh, it was with Fran. Okay.
But with Fran, you know. But I saw him as early as '80. I had bought their record when it came out, which was a mind blower. Their Girls Go Wild record in 79. But anyway, so they pulled up. I got my greasy apron on. I cook them eggs and bacon. I talked to Jim, and he says, yeah, well, I'm out, you know, I'm mixing an album at, I'm going back to the studio, and I had bought a tape with some stuff of my old band. Gave him the tape, and he said, y'all listen to this, which I doubt he listened. I don't have no idea. But he said, I got some gigs coming up. I'm, you know, it sounds, you know, it, you sound good. You're good. I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was, and he called me up. They left. He called me up about 2 hours later and says, you know, I can't really ask you to audition, but would you come to Austin and rehearse, you know, for a couple of days? I said, of course. And he said, all right, my manager will send you a plane ticket. So I went, you know, like 2 days later. So we had 3 days. I show up, and it's like in, you know, a little practice room with George Raines. And Bill Willis playing B3, who, you know, he's kind, really nice guy, likable right away. But he's legend, you know, he's bass player for Freddie King on all those King records, instrumentals and stuff. And I didn't know much about him then, but Jimmy had told me that. And Jimmy Vaughn, you know, I'd never, it was intimidating, you know, to me. And
so Bill was handling bass lines, right?
Yeah, so it was just a, yeah.
Was it
drums, B3, yeah, four piece, and then we had two backup singers. But they weren't there for the first practice, and they came in the next day, so we rehearsed like three times, and then we played four nights at Antone's. They had just opened the Antone's on Guadalupe and Fifth.
So what started off as like come out for a few days to rehearse and then turned into...
Well, yeah, it was like, then he told me, he says, yeah, and then, you know, 4 days after the Antone's gigs, we got some gigs in Europe. Can you do that? I was like, well, of course, you know, which I had no idea, you know, it was a single dad, my son at home. I had no idea how this was going to work.
How much time did you have?
Well, that's what I met him... it was probably a Friday that they came, or maybe it was Monday, because there's a car show that used to happen out there on Memorial Day weekend up in Paso Robles, and that's where they had been together.
So we're really coming up on the anniversary of that, by the way. We're close to...
Yeah. So if they came in on Monday, I'm not sure, but I think it was the following... it was probably a week that we played Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday at Antone's, which, you know, I'd played in Austin before. I used to play at the Continental Club and at Emo's occasionally. But Antone's was, you know, I'd been hearing about that since the 70s, you know, and that was like the epitome of where I wanted to play, what I wanted to do. You know, I'd been there once in the 80s, came to Austin, saw Albert King there. And so we had four nights there, and I was just trying, you know, I was when I got to Austin, Jimmy said, I said, well, what are you gonna, you know, because I knew his soul, he had Strange Pleasure, that record out, and I knew that record. I mean, I knew the songs. I didn't know how to play them. I never, you know, but I was like, what are you gonna play? And he handed me, he said, well, I wrote down some songs, and handed me like a yellow legal pad with, you know, every you know, a whole list, 30 some songs. I was like, okay. I guess it was I wasn't coming from like you do here, where you sit, you know, there's a bunch of bands playing and you play with different people, you do pickup gigs and stuff like that. Where I came from, there wasn't a scene like that, you know, so it was like you rehearsed stuff and worked it out and you had a band and stuff like this. This was new to me.
Right.
But anyway, you know, I don't want to be too long. So that was within, by the end of July, well, I got back to L.A. Like 2 days before my birthday when I turned 40. So between that time, I'd played 4 nights at Antone's. Then we went to play to Europe for 4 weeks, played Montreux Jazz Festival, North Sea Jazz Festival, Puisto Blues in Finland, which is huge, you know, a gig with B.B. King, where else, a couple of other festivals, some place in Spain, all over. I'd never done anything like that. Came back, that was, yeah, within 4 weeks from having met him, so that was... And I felt like, and yeah, just trying to learn the stuff. But those, you know, George Raines and Bill Willis were great to play with. They were real easy going. And of course, Jimmy, you know, he'd never say, play it like this or play it like that. It was just like, you know, just play music. Just don't stop. You know, if you don't know what's going on, just don't stop. You know? Like that was the direction.
Yeah, so he never did. It's not like you guys had to sit down and work out.
Nope, never have done
never
that.
Never happened.
Never have done that. He's always is just wants to. He puts together a band that, you know, sounds right to him, that he can play on top of, that he can depend on, and so, you know, he want, you know. Just like when we've gone into the studio, we did a series of like where we were just doing covers of tunes that he liked. And so we'd go in the studio and he would like pull up on YouTube like a Webb Pierce tune or something, and he'd play it long enough to where you'd hear what the song structure is. And then says, well, we don't want to play it like that. Just play it like you guys would play it. And we'd play it twice and that was it. You know, we'd cut, you know. All those songs, those last couple of records, they were called Plays, Blues, Ballads, and Favorites, I think. They were all 2 or 3 takes. And I guess he'd come back and do, because he'd do the vocals and guitar live because of the room sound, getting everything coming through. When he'd take a lead, it would be coming through his vocal mic and all that kind of stuff. He liked that sound. Those records sound great. But they're all first and second takes, you know, with, and the only thing, you know, he might pull back some stuff, but I mean, once Flanagan joined the band, he went on stuff that we had cut before, some stuff he added B3 to it, but yeah, all those records are very little, they're not worked over at all. Sounds like the way we play.
Right.
Which is great.
So, did you have to change up your whole life at that point? I mean, did you quit the job, or did you just take a leave of absence?
Well, I've always been really lucky. They, you know, where they were fine with me. They moved they would get somebody to cover my shifts, and then when I came back, I'd take the job back from them. You know, it was like nice. They were. That lasted about 2 years. My mom and dad came out from Virginia and stayed with my son for the first time. I went away, but then he got old enough to where I left him alone, which was a whole nother conundrum in itself, which he survived all that. But he's like me, you know, path of least resistance. So he would have a good time, because the first 2 years we traveled a lot, and then it was slow for a while. But ever since, it's been finding jobs where I can come and go, because I've always still, you know, as a sideman, it's hard to. I tried for a while when I moved into Austin to get local stuff going on, so that I could play all the time. And that would work, but it's still like, if you can't show up for the gig, no, I can't do it next week. It's somebody else steps in, and they're the ones that has the gig. So sometimes it's easier to find a day job. So I quit cooking and became a mechanic. My buddy Steve had a garage in Austin. I was still living in L.A.,
But that was something you had already trained to be a mechanic, or you just worked on
cars? No, I always had old cars, affordable cars, mm-hmm. that broke down on the road, and when it was in a band, I had my own band with a van, that kind of stuff. I was the one, you know, I always figured out what was wrong, so it was, you know... I have mechanical aptitude, but I've never been a mechanic.
This is, by the way, a talent that I think I've spoken about before on the show. Like, I tell, learn this, because you're very valuable to the situation if you can be the guy who can fix the van.
Yeah, or at least know how it all works, so that when you break down someplace, and you get, because you're going to get conflicting advice of what to do, and you know, it can be, you know, the numbers can sound huge. So if you know how stuff works, you can kind of figure the best path, you know, how to get through.
Yeah.
Every musician should know how to cook and know how to fix their fucking car. You know,
So what you for the first couple of years, you stayed in L.A., and just flew out when you needed to.
Yeah. I mean, he was great with that. Is that I would just get a plane ticket. I didn't know how it worked, even, you know, because before I had run the band that I had with, I had great guys in the band, but I was the one that, you know, booked all the gigs and arranged the transportation and stuff like that, so I knew what was coming up and money and everything like that. And then with Jimmy, I didn't, you know, like the first time we went to Europe, I missed them handing out an itinerary. I had no idea where we were going or where we were playing the whole time. You know, it was just like, oh, we're going to Bruges tomorrow, and I was like, okay. I don't know. I can't remember what the question was.
No, I was saying, so initially you stayed in L.A. the first
couple years.
And then what made you decide then to move to Austin?
Well, I was in Austin for 16, you know, I got the gig with Jimmy a year after I moved to L.A., and I was in L.A. for 16 years. You know, my son was growing up, and I didn't want to be away from him. Even though he moved, was on his own from 18. But I worked, and, you know, I had relationships, and, you know. So I stayed in Austin, and I worked a little bit in the film industry, drove a truck, was a Teamster. But that was the same thing. It's like worked sporadically because of the, you know, leaving with Jimmy. But then it was like in 10 years ago, played out here, and was right. We had done a couple of shows at Antone's and stuff, and Nick Kern had sat in with us, who I was acquainted with and always liked. You know, he's a great player, but, you know, he had had cancer for a year and a half or two or something like that, and this was right towards the end, and I guess I came out here right after he died, and I was just, you know, we did a gig, and I was hanging out with my friend Steve, and I was just thinking about all the, and seeing how much Austin had changed, and I was like, man, I should have, you know, I could have been playing more, I should have been, maybe I should have moved to Austin a long time ago, you know, I missed, you know, all these people that I've, friends and acquaintances that, you know,
right,
they're not here, and been in L.A. for so long, and at the same, so my friend had just bought a garage to keep it open. And he said, "Well, why don't you come out and work?" So I said, "Okay." So I moved, and we, at that time we weren't, Jimmy wasn't playing that much, or maybe he was, but I thought that, well, if I'm out here, maybe I can, you know, maybe Jimmy will play more, you know, local gigs, which didn't happen. But anyway, I came out here and, with the idea that I would play more, which happened for a couple of years. So it was, but it wasn't, I guess I moved out here because I wanted to live here before Austin completely disappeared, you know, because it had changed a lot. Because I spent a lot of time out here playing with Jimmy, so, and I had been out, spent a lot of time here the years before I played with him and saw how much it changed. So I was lucky I came out here when I did. And, you know, lucky. I mean, I, you know, live in South Austin on South First Street for the past 10 years, which this is the only area I really want to live in Austin. And just worked out that way. So.
So what was it like when you got here and you're saying you were doing other gigs?
C-Boys opened up fairly soon after I moved here, and I got a Happy Hour Monday gig for a couple of years with a little trio. We, you know, just played instrumental stuff because I don't sing. So that was, it was a lot of fun. We never, you know, sometimes we'd get people in there. And I was playing with Dylan Bishop for a while, who's a young guitar player who's really great. He used to come see Jimmy when he was a young teenager up in Dallas, where he's from. He moved down here as soon as he could. And yeah, for a couple of years, Billy Horton and I, Jimmy Vaughn's bass player, who also does a lot of other gigs and has a really great recording studio out in Bastrop. So we played with Dylan and had regular gigs at like C-Boys and the Continental Club. And playing with Aaron James for a while, which was fun. And I can't remember. And Jimmy's played enough. There was some lean years before I moved here where we didn't play a whole lot. But it's been fairly busy.
So you got to, I mean, we were talking before about George Raines.
Yeah.
Now, you played with him for, you were saying, what, 20 years?
20 years, yeah.
So, and you were talking about, because this has been discussed on the show, the idea of you played at George.
Yeah, I listen, yeah.
George says,
I mean, he listens, you know, it's like, don't get me wrong, he listens to everybody. He's got, but he has an idea how the thing should go. And you can depend on him to, you know, you could depend on him to, for what the arrangement was and, you know, how it ends. And what the tempo is going to be and how it starts, you know. And, you know, Yeah, you kind of play. I mean, playing with him is it's like the best thing for a guitar player. I mean, because I'm a rhythm guitar player. That's, I mean, I don't really have, I like sitting around and playing, but, you know, my whole job in Jimmy's band is to be in the rhythm section, which, you know, I like.
You don't consider yourself a lead guy?
No, not at all. I mean, I play in some other situations more, but yeah.
I mean, you will do lead if
yeah if it's got right. Yeah, and I'll do one, two. I'll go around two times at the most, you know. But playing with George and playing with Jimmy, you know, they both have distinct rhythm styles and under a feel for it that was undeniable. I mean, so I learned a lot from just playing. I mean, I remember a lot of gigs early on where I would just watch George's foot. You know, I always because Jimmy's got a way of playing with time a little bit. You can't, if I try to play rhythm, if I was trying to play rhythm and just strictly listening to him, it wouldn't sound right. You know, it's like you got,
he's going around it.
Yeah, yeah, or laying back a little bit or something. I don't know. I don't think about it that hard, but it was like George, it was like working with a metronome for 20 years or something like that. It was, and also the, I mean, he has a spare style. You know, he can play a whole lot, but, you know, that's what I really like in a drummer, you know, kind of a spare style. And, you know, that's probably how I play. I play as little as possible rhythm guitar, you know. And yeah, sometimes I used to think that I ought to be doing more. And like, you know, you listen to like a lot of the Chicago stuff with like on Little Walter Records with the two guitar players, Louis Myers and Robert Lockwood and people like that, and think that well, I guess I do try to, I don't try to do those exact kind of thing, but the same. There's a lot of times one of the guitars kind of buried. You really have to listen for it. You know, it's like, you know, that, what did Keith Ferguson say about bass? I can't remember. It's, yeah, you don't want to notice it unless they stop playing, right, something. And so that's like, you know, what I think my job is you don't really notice what I'm doing unless I stop playing. Then it's like a big hole. But so that's like currently, Jason Corbier is a good successor to George Raines. And Billy Horton's a fantastic bass player. So, you know, I play with those guys. And then it's, you know, with Flanagan's really, he's got a real rhythmic style. And he's not one of those, you know, up and down the keyboard B3 players. He's a real groove guy, you know. So that's,
you're locked in.
Yeah, that's, I've always been, you know, this being a drummer podcast, but honestly,
well, no, it's moved on from that.
Oh, has it?
It's,
well,
started as that, but
I've been fortunate to have played with great drummers most of the time. And that's the, I mean, I love guitar playing and crazy stuff, and, you know, the play, you know, that's why I like Jimmy so much. I mean, his guitar playing was just lethal when I first heard it. I had been listening to, you know, T-Bone Walker and Charlie Christian, Texas guys. I was listening to them before. I had just started to learn how to play guitar, and I meet these people today that, you know, they're younger people and they've only been playing a couple of years, and they play circles around me, you know, as far as
stuff.
I had no clue. Self-taught. There wasn't a band playing in Lynchburg where I grew up. I saw a lot of mountain music, a lot of banjos and fiddles and stuff like that. I'd see that. But, you know, so I was listening to T-Bone and Charlie Christian, and, you know, finding the records was hard too, and Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Robert Johnson. That's what I listened to. But then the T-Birds record came out, and it was such a... I mean, not only were they... They drew a lot of those... They had elements of a lot of that stuff in it. But they also introduced... You know, I'd never heard, like, Louisiana swamp pop stuff or some kind of low-down groove. And I hadn't really listened to Jimmy Reed that much. But they were also... You know, they were older than me a couple of years. But you could see from the record cover, you know, it was like they were doing it right then.
Yeah.
You know, because it was like, you know, I mean, Muddy Waters was still alive then. I never saw him play, but he was like opening up for Clapton and stuff like that. And, you know, he put out a record back then, 75 or something like that, Johnny Winter produced. It was great, really great.
Oh, I love those.
But,
records.
You know, they were old guys. Yeah, Hard Again. That was so fucking great. That, yeah,
Willie
it was
Big
like.
Guy Smith.
Yeah, which.
Pine Top?
Yeah, Pine Top. Yeah, that was like.
Recorded in the old schoolhouse.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was really cool stuff, and I really liked it. But then seeing the T-Birds, it was like. You know, they weren't a bunch of old men, you know, so it was kind of eye-opening. And
so you were always a blues guy?
Yeah, pretty much. I grew up with the Beatles. I was aware that, you know, saw him on Ed Sullivan, all that stuff, in small town that I lived in. And the radio was really good, AM radio. I'd hear stuff. But yeah, once I got to high school and started buying records, it was like, it's one place I went. I think the first one I bought was this Muddy Waters record, just the cover looked real cool. Not that Hard Again, it was the Best of Muddy Waters or Sail On or something like that. It's old Chess stuff. And yeah, I really liked that. And but growing up in the city, yeah, the Allman Brothers were huge, you know. Jimi Hendrix, of course, was huge. Sly and the Family Stone, that kind of stuff. But yeah, once high school and buying records, it was blues.
And you had bands, like you were saying, you ran your band in Virginia.
Yeah, I at the time I liked to drink a lot, and it was if you played, in a bar, and you usually got to drink. So it was like, that's where I want to be.
Right.
And I love music.
All night.
Yeah, and I'm the one playing music. So that was like, I love 3-4 set nights. You know, I just wanted to be there all the time. So I was in a bunch of different bands. But then I got together with these guys, Johnny Checa and Mike Geyer in... And we had kind of, I wanted to play a jump blues band, but they were the singer, who was a great singer, and he wanted to do like Bobby Darin and Sammy Davis Jr. and stuff like that, kind of loungy stuff that he could really sing, which was fun to play. And people liked it. I mean, they, you know, and that's the band that I first played in Austin. And that's how I met Steve Wertheimer, which is how I got the gig with Jimmy, you know, just...
He was running the Continental?
Yeah, so, yeah, he was...
That's how you met?
That's how I met. There. We play, yeah, we played there. We got beat fairly popular when we played there.
You guys hit it off over the car thing as well? Was that part of it?
No,
Something else.
Yeah, it was the music. I mean, Steve's all about music. That's his main thing. You know, the Continental Club and then C-Boys. You know, the guy is... He's all about music. And that's, you know, like seems to drive everything that he does is to support having a place for musicians to play. You know, that's... So that's, he liked the band, and, you know, he's a friendly guy, and we'd come, we'd play and stay for a little while. The singer went on to be I don't know if you ever seen the YouTube Puddles Pity Party guy, singer. Well, he's very, very successful doing that. He's a great singer.
So this was the Virginia thing, though.
Yeah. And so that
you hit the road. You would do that.
Yeah, we. We hooked up with this guy Elvis from out in Los Angeles, the Mexican Elvis, and he was doing these really big production shows at the time, the mid-90s, and he would have tours, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, and so a couple of times we would go with him and open up, and so that got us in playing a lot of places, and people liked us, and we'd come back. So pretty soon, I don't know, for 2 or 3 years, we played about 150, 200 nights a year on the road. But that fell apart through
excess.
Yeah. Well, I was married, had a young teenage son, and it didn't work with the
being on the road.
It didn't work. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
So things start to implode, and it's just personal.
Yeah,
stuff.
It was messy. It was messy, and that.
So did you have to bow out of the band? Is that?
Well, no. I bowed out of marriage. and then quit the band through some poor decision on my part, which was it had kind of run its course.
What does that mean? Was there a point you regretted it? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it was. There was no reason to quit it as far as our success. You know, we were. There was some friction in the band, but we were doing great. You know, we were playing places, and you know, we had recorded some stuff, and we're probably going to put it out. And
we were working.
But yeah, we were working. But through the probably the relationships that I was involved in, I thought it was a good idea to quit the band and, you know,
put the focus on that.
Yeah, put the focus on a relationship, which did not work, which is probably the best outcome of that. And
so did you go through a stretch where you weren't a working musician then?
Came back to Richmond. My son moved in with me. You know, I had a little house that I shared with some other musicians, and I worked two jobs, tried to get him through high school, and did that for, it seemed like forever, but it was probably only a year, a little less than a year, and then moved. I bought a, you know, cool old 70s Chevy van that was in great shape, and we threw everything in it and moved to California. you know, and that's, you know, a year after, and worked.
Now, is that, like, do you go cold? I mean, do you know people there, or do you...
Well, I had a girlfriend there, so okay. That was...
So she lived
and
there?
She lived there,
so
yeah.
Does that was, mean you had a place to go and live?
Well, yeah, it was, we had a place, it was real cool, on Venice Beach, right on the beach.
Yeah.
But it was a shared apartment with... You know, it was somewhat chaotic, you know, and I had a 15-year-old son who's great. I mean,
he just brought him along, and he just...
And I was... Well, I mean, yeah, he wanted to live with me.
No, but I just... You know, I mean, like, he, in the shares.
Oh, yeah, but,
he's just,
yeah.
He's right in it.
He's right in it. And then I had some acquaintances out there. I mean, we had played out there, then I walked into this. I figured I needed a better job, and I mean, this would be a long story, but there was a little restaurant in Silver Lake in LA that I had known the previous owner, and I thought I'd go up there and see if they had a job. And I walked in, there was a guy sitting there peeling potatoes. He was like, "Billy, what are you doing out here?" And it was like, I knew, you know, it was this guy Bob Forrest, who's like he had spent some time in Virginia in a, you know, crazy kind of alcohol and drug fueled time for all of us. And that's how I knew him. Apparently, we'd hung out a lot, which I didn't.
You didn't.
I have a lot of gaps in memories.
So you didn't even recognize him.
Oh, I recognized him. I was like Bob, but I didn't know I would get such a warm greeting. And it was, and I knew this other guy that was working there, Keith, who had been out in Virginia. Keith, who was like, you know, singer for the Circle Jerks. So it was like this kind of hip LA breakfast place. And,
where
you know,
was it again? Sunset and what?
Sunset and Maltman in Silver Lake.
Oh, yeah.
Sunset okay. Junction, where they would have it, yeah. Right in that area. And it was a little, very, very hip place, good food, really small.
But that is quite a commute, man, from
Venice. Oh, it was, I did that for like 6 months. But they, you know, so Bob was like, "We got to get you a job." And I was like, "Okay." And, you know, he introduced me to Patty that owned the place. And she said, "You know, can you start tomorrow or whatever?" And I was like, "Sure." So I worked there for a couple of years. We, you know, me and my son moved up to be closer. But that, so that's what I thought, you know, I was just getting to know LA. I loved it. You know, I moving from there, from Virginia, was like going to a different world, and then kind of knowing some people that were in, you know, in the area that I was living in. Yeah, it was great. So I wasn't too worried about music. You know, I was still playing at home, but right, I just right. Didn't see how it was gonna, you know. I
so
just thought, oh, this is...
You weren't actively pursuing, like, trying to get...
No, I didn't move to LA to make it in the music business.
Yeah, I was saying, you weren't, like,
no.
Trying to audition.
I was going... I chased a girl out there, and just that I wanted to... I was so... I mean, LA was cool. Cool. California had always been cool. I'd never been out there until I'd played out there, like, 2 years before that. I'd never been west. And it was like... You know, that's... I could see why people went out there.
It's,
you know,
seductive.
Yeah,
it is.
So I just wanted to go out there. It was like, I need something.
But you were okay with it. I mean, I'm saying at this point where you're talking about, you're,
yeah, I was okay.
Like, you're okay with, like, okay, I'm not going to be a working professional musician. Like, that's where your head was. You
know? Yeah. Well, I didn't really have a clue. You know, the success I'd had with the band before, the Useless Playboys, that was, you know, four guys in a van going, you know, driving 500 miles to play for a $50 guarantee, that kind of stuff. That's the music business that I knew, and, you know, which was success. You know, we had fans and, you know, handfuls of fans in different towns. That was great. But I did, as far as being, I didn't know how to be a professional musician, really. You know, people say, well, you're out in L.A. Have you tried studio work? And I was like, that, there's, you know, people don't have any conception of what that would tell me that, what it means to be a studio musician. It's like I have no skills like that. You know, I met some of those guys later, and it's just like, yeah, I couldn't, you know, couldn't do that. So yeah, I thought I was going to be an old fat cook, you know. that's what I thought I was going to be. So it was a surprise to, you know, meet Jimmy and do
right,
that.
Right, so back to that. There you are doing that. Yeah. Steve comes out, calls you, your life's going to change.
Yeah, and yeah, it did. I mean, yeah, I can't imagine what life, I can't. Yeah.
Had that not
where happened. Had that, yeah, I don't know what, you know.
Who knows?
But
who
I've knows? Always, yeah, I feel like I've always been lucky. Things have been easy. Things always work out, you know. I mean, you can see where I live, which is, you know, somebody listening might not be. It's like a warehouse full of junk, you know. It's like not a, but it's a cool space for me, you know.
Hells yeah. And you say you spend time in the desert in California?
Yeah, I had a friend when I was living in L.A. I had a friend that had a house out in a place called Wonder Valley. He had it for 10 years or something. He'd go, he was a writer. He'd go up there and spend a week up there writing and stuff. And I went up and did some work on the house. I'm kind of handy with, at the time, you know, doing minor carpentry stuff and stuff like that. And Wonder Valley is east of Joshua Tree. It's near east of the town of Joshua Tree. It's deep in the Nowheresville. And I loved it out there. It's cheap, and they got all these. It was the last place in the U.S. where they, in the 40s, they still had the Homestead Act, where they had all. It was zoned, you know, rural land. It was cut up into 5-acre tracts, and if you went out there and built a structure on it within 3 years, you could buy it for $10 an acre, something like that. So $50. So there's all these little, what they called jackrabbit cabins, which were like 170 square foot on a concrete pad, little cabins where people in the 40s and the 50s, you know, all the, in LA, all the aircraft industry, all these jobs out there, and all these people, and people would, and you know, also at the time, clean desert air for, you know, people with respiratory problems and stuff. And so, you know, $50 for a 5-acre, you'd build a little homestead cabin and go out there on the weekend or whatever, I don't know. And there's nothing out there, and you go out there and sit, it's hot as shit in the summertime. But so there's all this, they're all empty, you know, a lot of them. And there's, you know, of course, people that have been living out in the desert for years, and there's some crazy stuff, and but it's quiet, and the, you know, stars are really bright. So I found one years ago, and thinking that I would retire there. I haven't finished fixing it up. It's hardly livable, but it's on its way. But you know, in the past, especially the past 3 years, it's gotten real popular out there.
Yes.
Land, you know, Joshua Tree and Yucca Valley, 29 Palms.
You blew up.
It's, yeah, it's kind of blowing up, so I'm kind of...
That's nice. You got that. So you got, that's your land, right? That's...
Yeah, I do.
That's great.
I do own it.
See, it's, that was just, that was a wise...
Yeah, it was smart. I was so lucky that I, you know, was like, I had a small amount of money 10 years ago and went out there and, you know, bought it over time. It took me a couple of years. But, man, I got it cheap. It's cheap desert land.
Yep.
I mean, there's nothing out there. It doesn't have water.
No, but again, as you said, it's really blown up. So
yeah.
You got in at the right time, it sounds like.
Well, yeah, and it's still, where I live, there's Highway 62, which, you know, goes through Joshua Tree in 29 Palms, where there's a military base, and at, from 29 Palms, it goes, you can take, well, it goes down to the 10, about 100 miles. So there's a sign on the road outside of 29 Palms says, no services, 100 miles. And they're serious, you know, there's no, and I'm 7 miles past that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I like that. I like the isolation.
Yeah. So how often do you go out there?
A couple of times a year. I was just out there. So I have friends out there in various places. A band I play with now, a friend of mine, Sean Wheeler, who's a Palm Springs guy, the Desert Legend, Sean Wheeler, we've been playing together for a couple of years. He's a singer, great front guy.
I caught you guys at Sea Boys.
Oh, you did?
I want to say November, something like that, maybe November, December.
Oh, was that with Hunt or with...
Oh, yeah, with Hunt.
Okay, yeah, that's our Texas band, Hunt Sales and Emily Gimble and...
Well, no, it was not Emily. I think it was...
She might have... Michael Archer playing bass. Yeah, Emily didn't make that night because... if it was in November, it's because she was like 6 months pregnant. And she was like had played two nights with us, and she had had a gig that day, and so she was like going to take it easy.
So does that, when you say Texas band, does that mean you do... the non-Texas band as well?
Yeah, well, I just went out to Palm Springs and played a gig with Sean at the Alibi Room, which is a really great spot, just accompanying him on guitar, him singing and guitar, and that's how we started. But also in L.A., there's a guy named Danny Magoo, who's a keyboard player, great. He's kind of been in and around the L.A. music scene for a long time, and Greg Boaz, who's the bass player. But so we had to get this Texas band because Greg got the gig with Mavis Staples about 2 years ago, so he's busy all the time. So
you just Sean Wheeler, and you're saying, yeah, just playing the Texas band and the desert band, and
yeah, we do. We're trying to figure it out. We did some last time Sean was out here. We went to Bud's recording and service and cut six songs with Hunt and Emily and Mike Archer, which they sound great. I mean, they're not mixed yet or anything. I think they sound great. I'm so stoked. But I haven't, you know, it's up to me. I haven't done anything with them.
Right.
I don't know what I'm going to do. I mean, what do you do? What do you do nowadays? You know, it's all, I have a friend out in California that she made a video for of me and Sean for our, we did do a record a couple of years ago. And she did a video for one of the songs, this Captain Beefheart song that we covered. I like the video a lot. She's really great with that. And so I was going to get her to, you know, see if she would do a video for one of the songs this time. Then just put it up. I mean, that's what you do, I guess. You just put it up on YouTube. And nobody going to buy it, you know. So I don't know.
So have there been opportunities that have come up for you that you couldn't do because of scheduling?
I don't know. I mean, I've always put, like, Jimmy's going to come first, you know, and, you know, being able to make any gig that he's got. So I'm kind of on hold.
Or maybe it's the opposite where, like, so in other words...
Well, I've missed out on...
I'll say other gigs come up and then you say yes and then Jimmy calls and they say, we have these new dates and you have to cancel.
Well, usually I'm smart enough to write to the management and say, I'm thinking about doing this tour, you know. Are we doing anything in June? You know, that's what how I got up first playing with Sean Wheeler is that his friend Mark Lanigan wanted Sean to he was doing a series of shows 5 or 6 years ago, and Sean called me up to see if I could do it, and that was, so it was like 3 weeks East Coast and West Coast, and I just made sure that Jimmy wasn't doing anything before I said yes. And then it was, once I commit, then I would, you know.
You get the blessing from the Vaughn camp.
Well, yeah, that nothing's, right. Nothing's happening. And it usually, that usually works out that way. You know, I just, because right. they have to do stuff so far in advance. Most of the time stuff doesn't come up, like, all of a sudden. And if it does, it would be like a local gig, and I'd say, well, I can't do it. So, you know. They've done one or two without me, but I've made most every gig in the past 25 years.
So when's the first time you got to play with Hunt? Was it here?
Yeah, here. I was acquainted with him just in passing. HEB, it's where, you know, that local HEB up there at Congress in Oldsthorff. You know, that's how I kept up with people. Sometimes you'd run into them there. Just around, you know, he'd bring his car into Dave's Perfection every once in a while, and so we had a good time talking, and they was just like, I was just kind of wondering what, you know, what it would take to get him to play with, you know. And then when he did put out that record, the Hunt Sales Memorial, I went and saw him play a bunch, you know, him, Charco, and Mike Archer, and Dave Biller. They were so fucking good. So I was just, you know, in talking to him and hanging out, I was just in the back of my mind wondering what it would take to, whether that would work. And then one day I just asked,
find him. A situation where you can play with him.
Yeah, to kind of play. Well, also this thing I've got with Sean Wheeler, I was, you know, have thought is really good. And so I was thinking about that. But we were kind of, with that band, with Sean, we were not playing with drums. We were doing, you know, more atmospheric kind of thing.
Right.
And though Sean comes from a brash background, you know, that's not his usual MO, you know. I mean, he's done a lot of stuff, but... And we had put, you know, with Sean, we had bought our friends out from L.A. and played the Flesh Eaters, you know, John Doe and Dave Alvin and DJ Bonebreak, and those guys were doing some shows they hadn't played forever. And so we got the gig to open up for them in Texas. I mean, we did some in California, too. And so Steve, we played at Seaboys one night. It was perfect. We were really good. We played there, not with the... It wasn't a Flesh Eaters gig. It was afterwards. I asked Steve if we could play. And they all really liked it. So it was like I knew I could get a gig. So that was... And so then when I asked Hunt... See if Sean could come out here, and yeah, Steve gave us like 4 or 5 nights, you know, between Continental and Seaboys, just different, not, you know,
right,
support, just, yeah. Well, like playing with whoever,
right.
Just because he thought, you know, people would like it, and he wanted to hear us play, so, you know, that started.
So that's how you got Hunt involved in.
Yeah.
You introduced him to Sean. And,
yeah, yeah.
And you got to play with Hunt.
Yeah, I got to play with Hunt. So that's, yeah, Hunt, George Raines, Jason. I can't neglect to mention him. Jason Corbier. He does really, really good. He's a lot of fun to play with. He's a fun guy to be on the road with. Uh,
Yeah, I get it, man. I mean, you've gotten to play with some great people, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there was a first guy playing with, I played with good drummers in Virginia, too, this guy, Scott Minor, who, I don't know if the one or how many people listen to this, but he was with that band, the Useless Playboys. He was playing with us for a while. He was such a good drummer, had such a spare style, but really listened. He went on, he played with Mark Linkus in a band called Sparkle Horse after that, and did a lot of the production, engineer, you know. He was all around great guy, lives in Greece now, haven't seen him for a long time, but he was great. He really got me listening to drums, you know. I was still learning to play guitar, you know, still, so yeah.
You mentioned Keith Ferguson. Did you know him?
No, I never met him. I saw him play. It was like he had long, what I remember is really long fingers, and he played with his hands straight up like that, you know, with his straight up across the bass, and didn't really move, looked real cool, sounded great, you know. But that, yeah, they were so good back then. Yeah, never met him.
Right. So what's the plan? I mean, are you here? I mean, do you see yourself in Austin and the desert? Is that...
Well, I was supposed to be out, have my place fixed up and living out in the desert.
Full time.
Yeah, it's just like you know.
You could do it too, huh? You could live like that. You could.
I could. But then at the beginning of the year, or at the end of last year, because I hadn't worked, you know, we hadn't done gigs. That long pandemic really screwed with me. But at the end of last year, Mercury Charlie, who was a hot rodder, car builder that I've been acquainted with, you know, since early days of playing in Austin, just because he's a big music guy, you know, and he was always out at music and stuff, and always wanted to talk about cars. And he's got a shop out in towards Dripping Springs, Oak Hill. He called me up and asked me if I would consider working for him. So I said, I don't know what, you know, you might think I know more than I do, but it's because he's got a shop with, you know, they build cars. But I started working out there, and, you know, I can handle what they want me to do. So, and they're great guys out there. So now they'll let me go, you know. I say, well, I won't be back for 3 weeks or 4 weeks. And they're like, okay, you know. You know, I make sure what I'm working on is done by the time that I need to leave. But, yeah, so that's how can I... I'm not going to find a job out in the desert, and I don't want to work. I'm going to be 65 in a month. You know, it's like I'm top. You know,
you should, what you think? So, just keep up with the music part, though.
Yeah, I was. Yeah, not I was. I was. That. Yeah, I was. I was hoping that Jimmy would go back to sending me plane tickets, though. I don't know if the economy's going to do that anymore. I'd have to figure that out, but. Yeah, I'm going to play with Jimmy as long as he's playing.
Right.
You know, I mean, as I'm assuming, you know, I've made it this far. And, you know, we had a good time playing last night, so I guess it's going to work. Yeah. Yeah,
Yeah, there's more dates on the books, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We're busy this summer. Yeah. So that's great. Yeah, we're... doing some more big shows.
By the way, yeah, I was just going to say, you're opening for Clapton.
Yeah, we're...
And you're going to be playing the Garden.
Yeah, for number 8th and 9th time for me.
You have done it.
Yeah.
And you played Royal Albert Hall, right?
And Royal Albert Hall. We're playing Red Rocks again. That'll be the second time I've played there.
So what's for you? What was wilder experience, MSG or Royal Albert Hall?
Actually, probably Madison Square Garden, because I remember like when Sticky Fingers came out. I mean, maybe it was Sticky Fingers, or maybe it was Exile on Main Street. Anyway, you know, with the Dick Cavett show, I think they had a little interview with Mick Jagger. You know, I was 14 or something. And amazingly caught it on TV, because if you know back then you didn't see it, you didn't see it.
Yep.
And they had some film outside of Madison Square Garden of people, you know, scalping tickets and getting in, and then a little bit of footage inside. And I remembered that. And when you walk in there, the back, you know, the halls that go around the arena is real, real recognizable from that, and pictures of, you know, Robert Plant.
Yeah.
So I'd never seen the inside of Royal Albert Hall. I mean, that was fun to do, but Madison Square Garden was a big thing.
It's like the pinnacle, right?
Yeah, and it was, so when we went up there, it's like we had a hotel, you know. I could look out my hotel window, and there it was, you know, right down the street. So yeah, it was fun.
And you, because I did discuss this when George was on the show, that that Clapton had Jimmy Vaughan Band for his birthday party.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, for like.
And where was that again?
It was in London. Whitehall.
So he flew you guys over?
He flew us over, business class. We were the entertainment, you know, the band to play at this party. 300 people were invited. And so it's in this place called, I think it was called Whitehall, and which is, you know, part of the royal family's holding. It was, I was told it was King James, the King James Bible, that guy, the drinking hall and so the room that we were in, first of all, our dressing room upstairs, you know, there's a painting of Queen Victoria that my dad was a stamp collector, kind of, you know, and like when I was a kid with stamps, and that was the stamp was that painting. That painting was up there. And then Paul Rubens, the ceiling was all frescoes with fat ladies, you know, Paul Rubens. And that, you know, food, this spread of food, it was kind of dark in there. It looked like fucking Renaissance painting, like these huge cast iron skillets that are, you know, they were like 3 feet across, fit like with the wheels of cheese, you know, and grapes spilling out over it and stuff. Like, it was just, and we were up on stage and, or, you know, a little platform playing. I thought there would be like all kinds of legendary rock people there, but there wasn't. They were mostly like childhood friends and business people of Clapton. But it was Stevie Winwood was there, and he sat in with us, played B3. You know, it was like,
come on.
And I was like, wow, this is really cool. I was thinking, yeah, you played B3 on fucking Electric Ladyland, you know?
Fucking Winwood, I love it.
And he was really, really nice. And
now, does Clapton talk to you? Does he?
He has back then, the past couple of, because we've played with him a lot. And, you know, I mean, he says hi sometimes. But that's, you know, those kind of things, like, you know, there's the crew people walking around, and his crew is, they're like the top people, and they're doing business, you know, they're not taking care of their, you know, it's like you just walk by people, you know, it's like, and
I wasn't sure if he talks to you as like a guitar player kind of thing, like,
yeah, he has before, we've talked, he was asking about my guitar one time, long time ago. But yeah, I don't, you know, and I don't seek that out either. It's like we do.
I get it.
You know,
I do. I get it.
That's a cool thing with playing with Jimmy, though. It's like people are, because Eric, you know, is like, you know,
he's a fan.
Respects. He's a fan of Jimmy, like Bob Dylan's a fan of Jimmy. You know, so we did like two tours with him, and
with Bob Dylan.
With Bob Dylan, and Bob Dylan was, you know, I knew, you know, the '60s records inside out.
What
year
was
kid.
That when you toured with Dylan?
2006 and 2007.
All right, so that's, was it Charlie Saxon on the gig at that point?
No, Denny just started playing, Denny Freeman.
We'll get to that. So, yeah, and, yeah, so you got to work, you got to tour with that band.
Yeah, so, yeah, it was, and, which was interesting, and Denny is friends with Denny. Denny's great, was great.
Had you known Denny before that?
Yeah, because I replaced Denny in Jimmy's band, is what it turned out.
I didn't know that.
Because... when Strange Pleasure came out, Jimmy's first solo record, they went on the road for a year and a half. They played a lot. And Denny, I saw him doing it. It was the coolest setup. They had three backup singers. Denny played piano. He had a black grand piano, and he would play guitar on a couple of songs. Bill Willis was playing B3 over here on a white B3. And then Jimmy in the middle with these like two amps. He had this custom Tweed 610 amp and a matchless next to it, and him playing. It was the coolest looking stage setup, and they sounded great. So, but that the way they played for a year and a half, and then Jimmy didn't have any gigs for like a year, and so Denny was, you know. He started playing with Taj Mahal, and so he was in touring with that band heavy. So then when Jimmy was like, had all these gigs coming up, it's like, well, Denny's unavailable. So he had to find somebody, and which he didn't. That's where I came in, Memorial, you know.
Right, back to, right.
2 weeks before all these gigs started, Jimmy, yeah. You know, yeah. He put stuff off.
But you got to know Denny, what, on the Dylan tour?
No, I'd known him before. He was living out in L.A., and a friend of mine played at the Lava Lounge every Monday night, and I'd go on La Brea, and I'd go out there, and I think that's where I first met Denny out there, because he was friends with, you know, hanging around. He was doing gigs. I'd go see him a little bit, but I talked to him, you know. I had just gotten a gig with Jimmy, I think, and so I was like, I tried to pick Denny's, you know, asked him, what, you know, how do you play with Jimmy Vaughn? He just kind of looked at me like, that's your problem. You know, I mean, he was real, I can't remember exactly what he said, but it's just like, It was probably a dumb question.
Well, I've heard about. I mean, people have mentioned about him that he was like as if he was this character, and he was this.
Well, he was. He's very very friendly, very kind. But you know, when you heard him play, he had a real unique style. I don't know what to say. He was a really good.
He's one of a kind.
Definitely one of a kind.
And so yeah, so you had that was the Dylan tour, and you had Tony Garnier, right? And
yeah.
Did you and George Richelli was on the gig with Dylan, the drummer?
Yes. Yeah.
Did you get to know him?
No, not really. I talked. The only person I talked to was Danny. And a little bit with Donnie Heron, who played Steel.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, still at that time, I was still trying to figure out how to play with Jimmy Vaughn. You know, it's like, you know, that has been my. I've always felt like somebody's gonna like turn around and hear me for the first time and say, what are you doing here?
Imposter syndrome.
Yeah, definitely.
They're gonna find out. Yeah.
But I think why I mentioned that was like, you know, it's, I mean, I knew, you know, Bob did a couple of those records from the late 60s, Inside Out,
sure.
In the early 70s.
Sure.
And it's like, I don't want to say nothing to Dylan. What do you know? I got nothing to say to Bob Dylan that hadn't he? You know,
I'm sure. Yeah, he's probably more. What's the word I'm looking for? Like it's harder to would be harder to approach him than Eric Clapton.
Sure, but it's the same kind of thing. It's well, and also, I mean, I got to admit, you know, Eric's a good
intimidating. That was the
player. It's more intimidated by Bob Dylan, you know.
That's what I
just
was
thinking
saying, yeah.
About Bob Dylan. Though he did break the ice one time with me, but
yeah, that's different, I guess.
I wasn't I never was a British blues guy, you know. I've never sat down with an Eric Clapton record. You know, I haven't tried to learn or Peter Green or any, you know, any of that stuff. So, you know, I'm not. I've heard him play Clapton play a lot, and he, you know, he's really good, and there's some really cool stuff. But, you know, it's not. I'm more. I'm more of a Jimmy guy.
Yeah. I got you, brother.
Yeah.
Well, listen, man. I appreciate you taking the time.
Well, sure.
To do this.
Yeah, thanks for asking.
And,
how interesting all this is, I have no idea. But, you know, I like thinking about it sometimes. So, thanks for...
Yeah, man. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you, Billy. Right on.
You're welcome.